Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's editor. Nancy Picard is the Anthony, Agatha, and McCavity Award-winning author of 18 novels and dozens of short stories. Her work includes three continuing series and two standalone novels. One of those standalone novels, The Virgin of Small Plains, made the 2008 list of Kansas Notable Books and was also named a killer book by the Independent Mystery Booksellers Association. EQMM takes special pride in Nancy Picard's success since her first work of fiction appeared in our Department of First Stories. Here she is reading her story, Miss Grimshank Regrets, from our May 2008 issue. After the reading, please join Nancy and me and authors Margaret Maron and Carolyn Hart for an interview conducted at the Malice Domestic Convention earlier this year. This is the same interview that occurs after episodes 12 and 13 in our podcast series.
Miss Grimshank Regrets by Nancy Picard. My dear niece Sarah, while I do appreciate your mother's effort to encourage you to write thank you notes, I regret to say that your latest one was a bit of a mess. I mean this literally, not cruelly, dear. I realize you are only 10, but that is no excuse for sloppy work. Even a child such as yourself with a so-called learning disability can surely do better than that. Let me list the ways. 1. Wash your hands before you begin. Fingerprints at your age are no longer precious. 2. The book I gave you is entitled Anne, A-N-N-E, of Green Gables, not Anne, A-N-N, of Green Gables. Proofreading is next to cleanliness, my dear. 3. You wrote that you read the book and loved it, but a few examples of things you liked would go a long way toward proving the truth of that claim. 4. Do not ask an old woman, how are you? The answer is rarely, fine. Write instead, I hope this finds you well. I hope this letter finds you willing to do better next time. Your loving great aunt, Phyllis. P.S. Please tell your mother not to waste her budget on such fine stationery next time. You are but a young girl. Dime store writing paper will do just fine for you. Phyllis Shank laid down her fountain pen, folded the note paper in half, and inserted it into its matching envelope, which she then addressed, sealed, and stamped. She had only two more mailings to prepare on this lovely, sunny Saturday morning in June, and a stack of similar notes already completed. She would have looked forward to this weekly task were it not for the sad fact that the world needed so much improvement, and she had so little time to devote to it, what with her gardening and volunteer work, now that she was retired from teaching. But at least now that she was no longer molding ninth-grade minds, or what passed for minds, she had this opportunity to address others who might benefit from her counsel. Dear Mrs. Carson, your novel, Love's Mystery, came highly recommended to me by a person I had long considered to be a friend. After reading only the first chapter, I now know two things that I did not know before. 1. No one who would recommend any of your books to me could possibly know me very well. Apparently, she is not the friend I thought she was, a mistake for which I do not blame her, but only myself. You may rest assured that I have also written to her to tell her so. 2. Publishing standards have declined shockingly, which I pointed out in my letter to your publisher. It is clear you have some talent, which makes it even sadder that you would waste it on such a tasteless story with such offensive language in it. I'm sure you do not use those words in your own life, so I cannot imagine why you would inflict them on your would-be readers. I regret to tell you that I will never check out any of your other books from the library, nor can I, in good conscience, recommend them to my acquaintances. Yours truly, Phyllis Shank. Proofread, fold, insert, address, seal, stamp. From the stack of offenses she had collected from the past week, Phyllis picked up the thickest pile. It was composed of several articles from the local newspaper, each article marked up with strong red ink, grammar, punctuation, and spelling corrected, questions of fact circled, composition corrected with examples of improved style. When necessary, beside the reporter's byline, she wrote in legible block letters AAH, which stood for Affirmative Action Hire. She did not have to explain the acronym or even pen an accompanying note for this mailing, because the editor, Marvin Froelich, could count on receiving a full packet from her every Monday. He was, by now, after several years, cognizant of her abbreviations. The source of this latest mailing would pose no mystery to him. Phyllis sat back, satisfied with her morning's labor. Then she gathered the creamy white envelopes into a neat stack and marched them outside to her mailbox for her postwoman, Diane Stevens, to pick them up. Phyllis always tried to time her arrival at the box with Miss Stevens' arrival, so that she could let her know of any problems with previous deliveries or remind the girl to tuck in her blue shirt or comb her hair. Yes, it was a hot job, and yes, it was no doubt difficult to keep one's clothing tidy while carrying a heavy bag, but that was no excuse for arriving looking as if she had dressed in her truck. She was, after all, an official representative of the United States Postal Service, and the residents along the route were her employers. Lately, they seemed to miss each other, sometimes by what seemed to Phyllis to be only seconds. This time, Phyllis lingered longer than usual by the mailbox. When Miss Stevens still didn't come, Phyllis sighed, raised the flag to indicate there was mail to pick up, and returned to her house. It seemed a mere moment later when she glanced outside and saw that the flag was down again. On Monday, Sarah Bodine read the note from her great-aunt Phyllis and started to cry. When her mother, Amy, took the note from Sarah's shaking hands, she started to rage. "I could kill her for doing that," Amy told Sarah's dad that evening. How bad was it this time, and how did Sarah get hold of it? You read it. You'll see how bad it is. Sarah read it because she got home before I did, and picked up the mail before I could get to it first and throw the damn thing away. Why does your aunt do things like that? Because she's a bitter, nasty old witch who doesn't have a kind bone in her body. She calls Sarah's learning disability so-called. What? My God. Yes, and she said our stationery was too good for Sarah. Amy's face, tearful by now, twisted with bitterness. According to Aunt Phyllis, dime store paper is good enough for Sarah. She blew her nose on the tissue her husband handed her. Sarah and I picked out that stationery together, and we picked the best we could afford because we agreed we wanted to show people how much we appreciate it when they give us presents. If there is such a thing as karma, her husband said, letting the implication linger. His wife took up his sentence and finished it for him. Then my Aunt Phyllis is going to die of 1,000 paper cuts. He almost laughed at that because it sounded so silly. But then he looked over at a photo of their 10-year-old daughter, thought of how hard reading was for her, how she struggled with spelling words and composing paragraphs, and a rage equal to his wife's came over him. She was a teacher. Hal Bodine was indignant. For how many years? 150, Amy said with a half-sob, half-laugh. "Would you mind if I had a word with dear Aunt Phyllis?" he asked, his tone dripping cold contempt for the woman. "No," Amy exclaimed, and then she said gratefully, "I wouldn't mind at all. Somebody needs to say something." Sybil Carson opened the creamy envelope with some trepidation. Fan mail was such a mixed blessing. On the one hand, it could lift her spirits on a bad writing day. It could propel her back to her writing, feeling as if she had magic in her fingers. Mail like that made her feel blessed and grateful to get to do what she did for a living, however small that living was these days. But it could also plunge her into black despair on days like today. She was already teetering on the edge of giving up on her latest novel, even though she couldn't afford to give up. One more hard knock might bowl her over. It wasn't as if she could easily find another line of work. For one thing, she wasn't young, and for another, she didn't have any other skills. She'd been writing novels for 30 years, always thinking the next one would make enough money to let her relax a little bit. So far, that hadn't happened. People assumed writers were all rich, but she made just enough to barely hang on until she fulfilled her next book contract, and she wasn't even doing that this time. This book had been due 3 months earlier, but the story just wouldn't come. She had tried every writing trick she knew to fool herself into getting going again, and still nothing happened on the page that anybody would ever want to read. If she didn't meet her deadline, she didn't get paid. If she didn't get paid, neither did her bills. Please, she thought, as she slowly opened the pretty envelope, please be a nice note. I just can't take any criticism right now. Nasty fan mail felt like a slap out of the blue, like a hand shoving out of the envelope or computer to strike her hard enough to leave marks on her psyche, if not on her face. Sybil pulled the notepaper out and unfolded it. Maybe I shouldn't read any fan mail right now, she thought, before looking down at the words. Maybe I shouldn't take the chance of letting it demoralize me. But then she chided herself. Don't be a baby. Sticks and stones. Sybil read it clear through and then laid it gently down in her lap. Words can never hurt me. What an abominable lie that was, and always had been. Maybe, she thought, as a sob rose in her throat, I should write a novel about killing one of my readers. Hey, boss, Miss Grimshank rides again. Marvin Froelich's secretary tossed the weekly Monday missive onto his desktop with a grin. They had dubbed their volunteer editor Miss Grimshank as a play on her real name, which was Phyllis Shank. Once a week, like clockwork, which she would have derided as cliché, her copies of their articles arrived, all marked up in blaring red ink. Sometimes, Marvin admitted to his secretary, I like to imagine that all that red ink is her blood. Boss, his secretary laughed, you'd never get away with it. He sighed. I know, but wouldn't it be nice? What really ticked him off was that she was sometimes correct in the letter, if not the spirit of her corrections. He had even learned a few things from her editing. But that learning wasn't worth the price of how nasty it all seemed, and it wasn't worth the pain it caused the reporters who had seen that awful acronym, AAH. Affirmative Action Hire? What colossal arrogance! One of the victims had been a young black reporter with budding talent, but no confidence to match. The bigoted remark had set her back months. Only last week it had infuriated an editor who may have fit the definition of handicapped in terms of his paralyzed legs, but who was anything but handicapped when it came to brains and ability. Marvin had never meant for either of them to see the mailings from Miss Grimshank, but both of them had, by accident. One of these days, Marvin predicted to his secretary, our Miss Grimshank is going to get what's coming to her. She grinned. He didn't. And what is that, boss? She's going to get edited out. When Diane Stevens didn't find the usual stack of ivory envelopes in Miss Shank's mailbox on Monday, she sensed that something was wrong. Maybe the old biddy was out of town, but Diane doubted it, because Phyllis Shank never seemed to venture beyond her own mailbox. She even had her groceries delivered. Probably so she could tell the boy to tuck his shirt back in, Diane thought. Or maybe, she muttered to herself as she stared at the small house down the short walkway, so she can tell him that canned goods really should be double-bagged, and what was he thinking to put the frozen vegetables in with the loaf of bread? Diane tried to get herself in hand. The old woman could be sick in there. She went up the walk, hurrying to make up for her previous ill will. But when she reached the front door, she took the few seconds required to make sure her uniform was on straight and to pat down her hair. Not that either action would silence dear Miss Shank. No, no. If your uniform looked good and you'd just got your hair done, she'd still ask you if you really thought those shoes were suitable. Diane smiled a little as she rang the bell. It was funny, really, the way she hid from this resident so they wouldn't meet at the box. There was a conveniently placed tree, wider than Diane's own butt, which Miss Shank had remarked could benefit from the exercise of the job, where she could wait until she heard the front door close and the locks click. Then she counted to 10, ran to the box, opened it, pulled out the letter, stuck in the new stuff, and ran off to the neighbor's house before she could get caught. If the Postal Service had an Olympics for fastest mail carrier, Diane thought she might win it. When Miss Shank failed to answer the ring, Diane called her supervisor. And when the neighbor lady came over to open the house for the police, they found the homeowner lying at the foot of the stairs with strangulation marks around her scrawny neck. Red marks, red as the ink in her pen. When informed of the identity of the victim, the chief of police, who had been receiving his own regular envelopes from Miss Shank for years, exclaimed, "Good God, this will be the longest suspect list in history." He didn't add what else he was thinking, and the most sympathetic jury, too. If they catch me, it will have been worth it. Arnold Sullivan sat in his studio apartment and stared at the hands that had held the bitch's neck and squeezed. It had been the most satisfying few moments of his life. Again and again he reviewed in his memory how he had lunged, how she had gasped, and how she had looked as life struggled out of her. "I have finally figured out who you are," she had said to him on Sunday. He had put down the grocery sacks and asked politely, "Excuse me?" She'd put a finger to her nose. "Who is that grocery delivery boy?" I kept asking myself, because there was something about you that looked so familiar. And now I know. You're Sam Sullivan's older brother, aren't you? The grocery boy, who was 70 years old, said simply, Yes. She had smiled her vicious smile, the one she used every week when she handed him a dime. One dime, as if he were 10, as if it were 1928 instead of 2008. It was also the smile his brother Sam had said she'd had on her face when she read his essay aloud in class, the one in which Sam confessed to his feelings for another boy. She had encouraged them to write passionately, tell something secret and deeply true. She had promised nobody else would ever see it. It had been 1957. Sam was a small boy, physically, and a naive one socially. Arnold remembered his brother as being a sweet and innocent 13 years old, too trusting for his own good. 3 hours later, Sammy had hanged himself in the basement. She had worn that smile at his funeral. You're the older brother of that gay boy, aren't you? She'd ask him this past Sunday. I wonder what your parents did wrong, that they would have one son who killed himself and another who didn't amount to a hill of... She pointed triumphantly to the contents of one of the grocery sacks. Beans. And so he lunged, with these hands. The same hands that had cut his brother down before their parents could see Sammy like that. He hoped he had left fingerprints on her neck. He thought he might like to get caught, so he could tell the world what kind of person she was. Maybe they didn't know. Maybe they'd be surprised. Marvin Froelich read over his reporter's story about the murder of the retired teacher. They still hadn't arrested anybody because there were just so many likely suspects, including himself. The district attorney had confided to Marv, you know, even if we find who did this and bring him to trial, the defense attorney will have a field day proving how many other people hated her, and that's all any jury will need to acquit based on reasonable doubt. Marvin edited the article gently, with faint pencil marks, remembering how harsh red ink could appear. His secretary came in to take it from him. What did you say? She asked when he muttered something. Ding dong, he said, with profound and unashamed pleasure. Ding damn dong.
Miss Grimshank Regrets is copyrighted by Nancy Picard. It was recorded at the Malice Domestic Convention, as was the following interview. Good evening.
I'm very lucky tonight to be at the Boucher, at the Malice Domestic Convention in Washington, D.C., where I'm joined by three absolutely wonderful authors, Carolyn Hart, who has written many series, among them Henry O., who has appeared in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine at short story length and also appears at novel length, of course, and Margaret Maron, who has written stories in her Sigrid Herald series for EQMM and also writes those stories at novel length, and Nancy Picard, who has written Marie Lightfoot stories for us and also does that series at novel length, and Jenny Kane, of course, that she's well known for. Too many credits for all of these great writers to go into now, but what interests me to start off with is that they write short stories and novels, and so I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the difference between writing a short story and a novel and how you feel about each form. And why don't we start with... Margaret, who began her career with short stories.
Absolutely, start with me. I spent my first 12 years of my professional life, and I have not had a drink. Yes. I spent the first 12 years of my professional life writing short stories, and short stories was what I first sold, and this was where I had given my heart, and I thought this was all that I would ever do. And then the short story market sort of dried up, and I backed into writing novels. But I still do like the short story. And to me, the difference, which is not what you ask, but the difference between the short story and the novel is when I was writing short stories, I would get an idea for a plot, and then I would think of characters who could do the plot, so that it all seemed rather natural. When I came to write novels, I might have had started with an idea of a plot, but these characters would not jump through those hoops that I had prepared.
Isn't that interesting?
So I find that while short stories to me are more about plot, the novels are more about character. What do you think, Nancy?
I think that's true. Although I do really enjoy exploring character in short stories, I think because, although you can't get into them in depth, as I think you're implying, mm-hmm. I enjoy it because I will tackle characters in a short story that I would never tackle in a novel, mm-hmm. partly because they may be people I don't want to spend a novel's worth of time with. I recently had a short story published that was about a woman who killed her children. Well, I don't want to spend a novel's worth of time, months and months and months, with that mm-hmm. character, but I was happy to put her in a very short, short story. And there are other situations like that, too, in which I'll think of a character that either it's somebody who's unpleasant enough that I don't want to spend that much of my time with, or somebody who about whom I can't really devise a long story, but I'd love to write something short about them.
Now, you did start with short stories, didn't you? In fact, didn't you debut in our Department of First Stories?
I did. Bless Ellery Queen's heart. Yeah, yeah, I departed it. I departed. Let's hope not. I started in your Department of First Stories, but I started a novel at the same time. You were the first place I was published, but at the same time I was working on my first novel because I had been I'd been a professional writer and I'd been a freelance writer, and one day, in a fit of madness, I gave all my clients, my paying clients, 30 days notice, and 30 days after that I was writing fiction full-time and have been doing that ever since. So when your acceptance came, it was just one of the greatest days of my life. And actually, if I may say something about your sister magazine, my second published short story was for Alfred Hitchcock's Mysterious Photograph.
Oh, was it really? Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And what is that, 250 words?
Yes, it is 250 words. Yeah.
So when people talk about writing flash fiction these days, I think, well, I did that for Alfred Hitchcock.
So you can do any length, literally.
I'd like to yes.
Well, actually, I don't feel that I belong in this august company because I am not an accomplished short story writer, and I came to that kind of writing very late. I had written a great many novels before it ever came my way to be invited to do a short story for an anthology. And although now I find it easier to say no, at that point in my life, if anyone asked me to write anything, dog food recipes, whatever, I would try. And I have great respect for people who write short stories because they are able to take a little moment in time and bring it to life to the readers. And I think my problem is that I can't ever tell a story without going into enormous detail. And my husband will say when I'm trying to describe what happened during my day, well, yes, but yes, what happened? Get to the point. So I love short stories. I think they're wonderful. I wish I were better at it.
But actually, Carolyn, I have to say that in just, 7,000 words, maybe less, with the story you podcast for us, you've recreated a whole era. So you are able to do something in it. It's quite significant in a short space.
7,000 words is a tenth of a novel for me.
Oh, okay.
She's on to me.
Yes.
It's like poetry. I think if a poem goes much past one page, maybe it's a short story.
Yeah.
If a short story goes much past 2,500 words, maybe it's a book.
Well, and actually, the character in this particular short story went on to be the central character in a novel.
In Letters.
In Letter from Home.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So. Oh, I remember that short story. I loved that short story.
Thank you.
I was really happy when that became a novel.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I enjoyed writing it. You know, it.
See, you can enjoy writing.
Well, it's occasionally.
But you're already thinking as you're writing it of the book. Were you thinking of what?
Yes, yeah. I was. I was thinking about a book.
I see.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's where the first Deborah Knott came from. It was a short story, and Sarah Paretsky did a Woman's Eye anthology, and asked me to do a short story, Created Deborah Knott. I'd been thinking about doing this character, but that was the first time that I had actually tried out that first person mm-hmm. smart mouth persona. Mm-hmm. And I'll always be grateful to Sarah for doing that anthology and inviting me to be in it, because I mean, I'm sure Deborah would have come anyhow. But that short story gave me a chance to
crystallize
the voice, mm-hmm. just as you did.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I had just the opposite experience in the fact that a short story has never given birth to a novel for me, but a short story for you, Janet, and Ellery Queen let me continue my trilogy of Marie Lightfoot after I wasn't
finished
going to do the series anymore. And so I got to do a long short story to spend a little more time with Marie, and I really loved being able to do that.
Do you think you'll do anything else with Marie?
I don't, unless it would be a short story. She was always going to be three books, mm-hmm. And so I don't think I will. Right. I was just going to say another advantage to me of working on short stories, a two-part advantage. One is you can finish them.
That's nice.
And the other is you can, I think, for me at least, get closer to having it turn out the way you originally envisioned it to be, or having it be as good as you wanted it to be, where with a novel, there are always parts that if I were smarter or better or had more time or whatever it is, I would go back in and rework some more. But I've written a few short stories that I think I wouldn't change. Mm-hmm. And I don't have that feeling with my novels. You all may have different experiences in that regard. But
no, you always want to smooth the cowlick and tuck in the shirt.
Oh, every time you go back over a book, you know, when I get a copy edited manuscript back, I love that period of time because I'm going to go over every word, every sentence, every paragraph, mm-hmm. and I will hear writers say, oh, well, they only had a few little things, and I'm thinking, well, why weren't you going over them?
Yeah,
you know,
oh, right.
This is your
last chance.
Yeah.
Before
this is your last chance.
That's right. And I recently, I shouldn't tell this probably, I recently discovered there was one more chance than I knew, which was to go over the second pass galleys of a book rather than just the first pass galleys.
To make sure they made the corrections that you want. Yes,
exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I know. After all these years, I just found that out.
You mean they didn't make the changes that you had asked for?
Sometimes an error could occur.
That's right. Sometimes an error can occur. And
mm-hmm.
I've
never had that happen.
Well, I had a major change, mm-hmm. law change, in galleys this time. Mm-hmm. And so I really, and my publisher is wonderful, copy chief, and I knew she'd do her best to get it in, but I was paranoid and wanted to make sure because it was so important to the book.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one or two small things had not gotten in, although the big one had. So mm-hmm. I'm always going to, from now on, ask to see second pass, I think, to make
sure.
Well,
thank you, darling.
In.
I'm going to start asking too.
Oh, this is terrible. Copy chiefs, if any copy chief hears this, they've gone white.
No. Well, Nancy, you had mentioned to me once, I think, that you feel that the tone of your short stories may be very different from what you write at novel length.
Well, that's what my book editor says. She thinks my short stories are much cooler, chillier than my novel tone, and I think some of them are. I think there are some others I've written that she may not have read that have a warmer tone to them. But if I'm going to write a colder tone, I'm going to do it in short stories rather than in novels. Because, again, it comes down to what do I want to spend that much time on? And I want to spend more time on something with more warmth than mm-hmm. I do with something that's cold.
I keep thinking of Blue Moon.
That was a cool one. It was definitely.
It really was a cool short story.
It was.
And where was that published, Nancy?
Was it your... I think it was your Valentine Day
was
anthology,
was it the Valentine
Caroline?
Anthology?
Caroline.
Oh, I think it was. Uh-huh. I think it was.
Yeah.
Do you find anything... Has anybody commented to you that your stories are different in mood or tone from...
No, not really. I get that with the difference between the Sigrid Harrell books and the Deborah Knott books.
Uh-huh.
People tell me they don't seem as if they were written by the same person.
Yes.
Because I do deliberately cramp my spirit when I'm writing Sigrid Harrell. And again, I have to thank her for letting me have another bite of the apple mm-hmm. and do another Sigrid Harrell story.
You mean Janet?
Yes.
We had two stories, I think, since you stopped doing the novels.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really getting a sense here that Ellery Queen's magazine is rather important to us. It's played really pivotal roles in all of our
careers.
When
I first started writing short mystery stories, Ellery Queen was the pinnacle.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
And people would say, you know, well, where should I send my this, that, or the other? And I always said, start at the top and work down. Mm-hmm. So I always started with Ellery Queen. And I always got the rejection slip back within two or three weeks. And my first short story was published in Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. Which Eleanor was still editing then, though, right?
Janet wants to make sure it's not that she was not editing. No. Well,
but I thought that maybe Eleanor was Eleanor at one point edited both magazines.
No,
so
Kathleen
was there.
No, it was when Ernie Hutter. Before
the company owned both magazines. Yes. Okay.
Yes. Ah. Hitchcock was a separate.
I see.
Entity, yeah. And I had sold several stories to Ernie Hutter, who was the editor down there in Florida, and I just thought Ellery Queen was the top, and then Alfred Hitchcock was next, and then it just sort of, you know, then you had Mike Shane, and you had The Executioner, and you had a lot of magazines that I put out of business.
They're not there anymore.
They're not there anymore, and I was in the last issue. So you, I better not say this, or you won't buy any more.
I think it would have happened by now, Margaret. I was going to with your stories, but which story is going to be the one? Well, you're bringing up the different mood between the Sigrid stories and the Deborah Knott books brings me to another topic I wanted to ask you all, because you've all written mysteries at novel length, at least about set in small towns. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you why you chose small towns. I mean, I know that the reason in some cases is that you're from small towns, but do you like writing mysteries in that type of setting, and how does it differ from choosing a city setting?
Well, I have done both, because some of the Henryo books are not in, they're on San Antonio, mm-hmm. and fairly places like that. But with the Death on Demand series, I wanted to set it on a sea island, so by definition,
yes.
It's going to be a small community. Yeah. And I do like writing about a small community, because people know more people. And the thing about the traditional mystery is that we're dealing with people who have relationships with many others around them. And it's when those relationships become twisted and soured that we have the basis for a mystery. And I think that we can focus. But, you know, anybody, well, let me put it this way. When I wrote the book about the little town in Oklahoma that was set during World War II, Letter from Home, I grew up in Oklahoma City, and it was not a big town during the war years, but it was, 100,000, 200,000, something like that. And when Tony Hillerman, bless his dear, generous, kind heart, gave me a quote for Letter from Home, which is set in a very small northeastern Oklahoma town, and we were speaking on the phone, and Tony said, "What little town did you grow up in?" And I felt like someone had just handed me the moon. You see, Tony grew up in Sacred Heart, Oklahoma.
Oh.
So he really knew small towns in Oklahoma. So I don't know. Margaret?
You find small towns anywhere. I love to visit my agent up on the Upper West Side. We walk out onto the street. We walk down Broadway. She runs into her classmates' parents. She runs into old classmates, people she's known for years. My editor used to live down near the Village, and that was a whole different neighborhood, too. It was like a small town. Her husband knew every store owner, every hardware shop, every place she got the keys made, every deli. And it was like a small town. Now, take him above 14th Street, and he was lost. And I don't think Vicky would be that comfortable below 45th, maybe. But so even New York City can be a small town
if
you've lived there long enough. Mm-hmm. And I do like writing about relationships and how the community impacts on each other. So, but it doesn't have to be a rural small town. It could be New York City.
It's so funny, Margaret, because I tell virtually an identical story about my agent on the Upper West Side. Mm-hmm. About, and that I had an epiphany about small towns the day I walked out with her. And we went to the little bitty grocery store, and they asked about her mother, and she asked about their kids. And we went to the dry cleaner, and they knew her by name, and she knew them by name. And she, just as you said, and I thought, this is her small town.
It is.
I grew up and I've lived all my life in the Kansas City area, and Kansas City's not a quote-unquote small town. And yet, I spent my early lives in a family. I was an only child, and we went to a big Presbyterian church. It took up an entire block. It was big enough to be a small town. It had enough members in it that it was like a small town. We were there Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night for potluck dinner. We were there for choir practice. I was there for Sunday school. I will say that I left when I was 13 and never went back. You know, you leave your small town. I loved it. It gave me such a sense of security and safety to have that small town in my big city. I love the idea of a compressed, well, it really goes back to the English Agatha Christie country manor. We make our small town is our country manor, and we have a certain number of people, and it's all kind of compressed, and emotions are compressed, and things can explode. Mm-hmm. And I think that can happen in any neighborhood in a city as well.
Oh, I do too. Mm-hmm. You know, violence and unhappiness and misery are everywhere. They're not just the back alleys. You know, they're in at the PTA just as well.
As is generosity.
Exactly,
and
kindness
heart,
and goodness.
The sort of thing that people associate with small towns without realizing they may be experiencing the same thing with their very kind next-door neighbors or whoever they may happen to be. Yeah.
You all have written series as well as non-series books. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of working on a series as opposed to a non-series book?
Well, actually, I remember when I wrote the first book in the Death on Demand series, and I hadn't sold any books in a long time, and I was so fortunate, and it sold, and the agent said, well, they want to know if it's a series, and I said, oh, of course, and I had no idea.
It's never occurred to me. So the market entered into that as well.
Right. Yes, and I think now I feel so comfortable in a series. Uh-huh. I enjoy revisiting these characters. I still enjoy Annie and Max after all these years. They will always be young and happy on their sea island, and it's a pleasure to me to join them there. I love my new series with the red-headed ghost who comes back to a little town in Oklahoma, and I have probably bid farewell to Henry O. in the Henry O. series.
And why is that? Oh.
Because they want two books a year, and they want one Death on Demand and one ghost, and
I
can't manage any more
third,
than
yeah.
that.
You would be the ghost.
I would be the ghost, right. Yeah. But series are so much fun. You know, they give you this sense, it's that community, you know, mm-hmm. and it exists in your mind, just like Margaret with Colleton County.
Yeah, I do feel like it's out there somewhere.
Exactly.
And every time I get to go visit it. But to address your problem, we can do this in short stories, do the different mm-hmm. voices mm-hmm. and do the different places. And as Nancy was saying, you can explore little facets of life that you couldn't necessarily in a novel. Certain things had happened to me. For instance, when I was a child, I remember very distinctly walking out one moonlit night when you could do this in the country and not worry about anything happening to you. And it was a beautiful moonlit night, and I walked down to the edge of the woods, and beyond that was the cornfield, and I heard corn growing.
Uh-huh.
You could actually hear the squeak and the pop
of the
plant, because it had rained, and then the sun had shone on it, and it was 6 inches taller the next day. And so you could hear it growing.
And that is one of the most beautiful passages in Bootlegger's Daughter.
Well, thank you.
It is.
But I carried that image in my mind all the time that I was writing the New York books. There's not any corn growing.
Yes,
in that
right.
I'm sorry. So I didn't know what I was ever going to do with it. But then when I did start writing the Deborah Knott books set in the country, there it was, and I could use it. And so I really do enjoy coming back to the series, but I do also occasionally like to write something standalone. So far I've only written two standalone novels, but all of the short stories have pretty much
Ben Stan, that's, mm-hmm. yeah, except for the cigarette stories,
yeah.
right?
I am I the only one who's actually worked on three series here?
No, because I have three.
You have, yeah. oh, that, no, of course, you have three, too. Mm-hmm. Well, my third one was the three books I did for the Virginia Ridge Estate, and I loved working on series when I worked on them, but there came a point at which I really wanted to do third-person, multiple point of view, and my series were first-person. My Jenny Kane series was first-person. Marie Lightfoot was, well, a mixture of things, but I wanted to do strictly third person,
but Nancy, you did that. You were the first one that showed me that you could mix.
Oh well,
first
I cheated.
And third.
That's true. I cheated. But Jenny was essentially Margaret's talking about when I did Marriage is Murder for the first time. I had a situation in which mm-hmm. I really wanted the reader to be on the scene of the crime, and I couldn't get my first person heroine on that scene. So that's where the first chapter came, and that's when I did that for the first time, I believe. And it was kind of considered cheating in those days. But I thought if you do something while I'm writing, you can get by with anything.
Exactly. And you didn't mm-hmm. even necessarily start separate chapters. That's how I keep it differentiated now that I'm using third person and mixing first and third. Uh-huh. I will start a separate chapter so that I never lose the reader. But you did it so seamlessly in a couple of those Jenny books. Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, thank you.
That
oh, good.
Even though you went, you had first person part of the chapter, and then you had the big page break, mm-hmm. and then you got into the third person viewpoint, and you did it so seamlessly that I was halfway through the book, and I thought, hey, wait a minute. She's cheating. Oh, I wonder if I could do that.
I love that. Well, you know, the honest truth, and I'm just realizing it now as I'm sitting here, is I've actually tried first person when I've, in the two standalones I've done in the last few years, I've tried it when I've run into a problem, and I've written half of a book, sometimes rewritten it in first person, trying to see if I could make it work. And it didn't work. It's as if I can't write first person anymore. What it has done for me has been to give me greater insight into whatever character I'm writing in third person.
Exactly.
But I seem to have lost the knack to write in first person.
Oh, I doubt that.
I don't know if
it's riding a bicycle. You mm-hmm. can get it.
Well, back. Maybe. If mm-hmm. But I'm really happy doing third person. So,
well, I like third person. I do third person in the Death on Demand books because I can obviously move from viewpoint to viewpoint. But I very deliberately made my ghost book first person, and I do have to believe that it's the only, I mean, the paranormal has exploded, and honestly, I wrote that book before that all started, and they sat on it for about 2 years. but what distinguishes the book, I think, makes it a little unusual, is that the ghost is the protagonist, and everything is seen from her perspective in first person. But what that does in that book is it's the omniscient viewpoint. Because, of course, she can disappear, and she observes people, and the only stricture is that whenever she's observing characters interacting and overhearing them, there has to be a real reason why she chose to be at that moment where she is.
I also think it's really important that Bailey be in first person because there's a certain sweetness to her point of view
yeah.
that I don't think anybody else can give, and that's such an important tone of those books.
Well, thank you, Nancy. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Now, Nancy, I wanted to start with you with this question because I think when you did make that shift to non-series books, some reviewers said this is really a shift for you to more mainstream sort of books. So what do you feel the difference is between writing books that fit snugly into the mystery category and those that might be considered more mainstream?
Somebody recently described this for me in a way that made sense to me that I didn't understand. I am and always will be a mystery writer. That's where my heart is, that's where my head is, that's who I am. However, there came a point at which I wanted to do, as this person said, not even talking about me, I don't think, wanted to set a mystery in a larger tapestry of life. And for me, that meant more viewpoints, something that I call for my own use, a 360 view of an event. And I wanted to be able to go into all these heads around this event in order to show the impact on this. And I wanted to be able to see not just the events of detecting a crime. I wanted to know what happened before the crime, and I wanted to be there. I didn't want one character telling another. I wanted to be there. I wanted to be on the scene of the crime, and I wanted to follow people after the crime. That's a bigger book than I have been writing before. So if that makes it mainstream, then I guess I'm heading more toward mainstream territory, but what I feel as if I'm doing, I mean, and that would be fine. Mm-hmm. I'd be more than happy to have mainstream readers. But I just think it's real important for me as a writer to remember, you know, the old saying, dance with the one what brung you.
Right.
You know, mysteries brung me. So yeah. I'm going to keep dancing with mysteries at the
good.
Heart of whatever
I'm glad
I
to hear that. Margaret, your books are taught in courses of Southern literature, and you've also won literary awards. Do you make any distinction between the work that you do that is...
No, I'm like Nancy. I'm perfectly happy to be called a mystery writer. I really don't try to categorize my work or make definitive statements of mm-hmm. it. I feel that that's the, you know, I write the books, I send them out. Whoever wants to take them can. They can say whatever they want to say about it.
Right.
I really don't care
yeah.
at this point. I really don't. I mean, I like a good review better than a bad review.
Sure, yes.
But as far as saying you're literary or you're not literary or you're trash or second rate, I don't care. That's nothing to do with me. I do the work. I do the best work I can. I put it out there. And then we see what happens.
Right.
You know, I really do think that's really true. I often think it's none of my business what somebody thinks of my work. You know, mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. their business.
It's
exactly.
A subjective
uh-huh,
thing.
Uh-huh.
It's their response is theirs.
That's right.
Yes.
And I'm mm-hmm. like you. I'd much rather have a good review than a bad review. And if they want to go into hyperbole and talk mm-hmm. about that, that's
yeah.
just
yeah,
fine.
And find symbolism.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The
right.
first time.
Be my guest.
The first time one of my works got picked up for a textbook. And it was a short story. And I'm reading the questions at the end of the short story. And they're saying, notice how the author did so-and-so. And did you catch the symbolism? And I'm going, really? My goodness.
We do a lot at the unconscious level that other people have to bring to our consciousness.
I know. And when somebody does a paper on you, and it just blows my mind. I mean, that somebody's going to sit down and analyze my work.
Well, there are all sorts of scholars now of the mystery, and I'm sure they're studying your work and writing papers and dissertations. And
because I do issues that face the South.
Yeah.
I mean, I do try to, not every book, and I certainly try not to preach, but I do want my readers to think about some of the problems that we're facing here at the beginning of the 21st century. And I really hate it when I feel like that we are selling our birthright for a mess of pottage, to quote Genesis. I mean, as Nancy would tell you, half of my influence comes from Sophocles in the Bible.
Oh, okay.
That's right. We were doing a panel together once at, where was that?
I don't remember. We've been on a few panels.
And somebody said, you know, where do you get your ideas? And I said, from the Bible and Sophocles. And,
yeah.
and someone else said that she got hers from Mother Goose. We had a lot of fun with
yeah.
that panel.
Yeah.
Well, I always love the question of where do writers get their ideas. And, you know, some writers get really kind of snippy when they're asked that. And the truth of the matter is that almost everything in every book that a writer writes comes from some source. Mm-hmm. And I the story I'd like to tell is, let me see which book is it. I think it was in Dare to Die, which came out a couple of years ago. A young man is talking to Annie, and he's describing the girl that he knew when they were both in second grade. And he looks at Annie, and he says, we were yellow birds. And she said, well, what was that? And he said, well, you know, the good readers were the bluebirds, and the okay readers were the redbirds, and then there were the yellow birds. And Iris and I were always the yellow birds. And there's more to that story, but the basic part of that story came from the fact that when my husband was in the second grade, the teacher divided the class into the bluebirds, the redbirds, and the yellowbirds.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband was a bluebird, but he never forgot the yellowbirds.
Mm-hmm.
And told me that story
yeah.
many years later. And then it ends up being a scene
yeah.
in a book.
More than 50 years later. No, yeah. 60. I mean, I'm okay.
That's wonderful.
A good many years ago.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes we're like birds building a nest. You know, you take a string from here and a feather from over there, and by the time you finish, you've got your nest. Uh-huh. But to say that I'm going out and get just strings or I'm going out and just get feathers, no.
And sometimes you just take somebody else's feather and somebody else's string. Carolyn took her husband's feather for the
story. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Mary Roberts Rinehart compared writers to crows, and she said that crows pick up bright objects and take them and hide them. And then when they want them, they go and get them. And that's what writers do. We collect odd and unusual and different things, but someday we'll use them.
The older I get and the longer I write, the more I'm aware of the fact that when I start a book, I can't do it unless it's some idea that has haunted me or won't let go of me. And you know, always people will say, well, do you worry that somebody's going to steal your ideas? And never. For one thing, if they use it, it'll become their idea and they'll put their own slant on it. But the other thing, and I also never worry about forgetting an idea. If I forget an idea, then it wasn't a strong enough idea to hold my attention. The ideas that go into my books are ones that may have been tugging at me for a very long time. And finally you have to work them out. If you can't work them out in life, then you can work them out in your fiction.
Right.
It's funny about, you were talking about the ideas, like you have a really rather important idea about your Judge Deborah stories in which you want people to be aware of what they're so blithely giving away in the terms of the beauty of North Carolina and other things about the heritage. My version of that is in Kansas. I live in a state, as does Carolyn to some degree, that is viewed as a stereotype by a lot of people abroad in the world. A flyover state. To me, my state, as Carolyn says to her, is beautiful. And I know these people intimately as real, whole people. And there's plenty of criticism abroad about Kansas, much of it richly deserved. But I'm happy to let other people write all that. What I want to write about is, and what's new and fresh, as far as I'm concerned, what surprises people is not the negatives, it's the positives. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I want to write about, I think, you know, we could all write, I could write about whatever is going on politically in Kansas at the moment, and there's always controversy of some sort. That's going to change 5 years from now, and it's going to change in another 5 years, but there's certain underlying values, and values is the wrong word, but a certain underlying humanity in for both good and ill that doesn't change so much, and that is common, I think, to people all over. It's a truism, but we forget it when we stereotype an entire state. So, you know, somebody wise recently said that the minute you judge someone, you stop understanding them. So what I want to write about when I'm writing about my state of Kansas is that moment, but it's the place where you don't judge, you understand. And that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with anything contemporary. So I sort of aim for a tone that is kind of timeless, I hope, that isn't rooted in whatever's going on at the moment politically.
Oh, right. I feel that very strongly.
And I think that we share that, the three of us share that.
Well, Eudora Welty was famous for saying, let your stories grow out of the ground beneath your feet.
Oh, exactly. Yes, that's
and
wonderful.
That's exactly what we're trying to do, I think.
Yeah, I can see it so much in both of your work.
Well, that's why I'm so happy to be writing a series set in Oklahoma. It's been such a pleasure, you know.
Well, when she was writing the Jenny King books, the Jenny King books were perfectly fine books set in New England.
They were
delightful. But the book that I loved the most was Bum Steer.
And
when she took
did.
Her to Kansas and got her hands dirty.
That's right.
And it was so real.
Yeah. I don't know why it took me so long to... Even the Fort Lauderdale version that I wrote in Florida was more real to me because I knew it in a way that I had never known New England. Knew it and loved it.
And why did you choose New England originally for that?
Because some pretty mundane reasons when I was first starting out. At that time, regional mysteries were not popular and were not being bought. Virginia Rich was about the only one who had the nerve to set a mystery in a small Midwestern state, in a state, in a small town in the Midwest. And I thought, okay, I could write a novel, my first novel, about somebody in a small town in Kansas, and it's going to land on a New York editor's desk, and it's going to of nowhere. Or I could set it in New England, which I've always loved, and which I where I would live if I could. At least at that time, I felt that way. And it would have a much better chance of selling.
Well, actually, that was the precise reason I chose South Carolina. And the reason why is that I wanted to use a vacation background for the mystery bookstore. And the only vacation background I knew well was Hilton Head, South Carolina, because we started going there in the 70s. And we've been going, you know, gosh, 40 years now. Mm-hmm. I love South Carolina. They are so nice to me. They treat me like a South Carolina writer, and I am so appreciative. They're the kindest, nicest people. But what I really love about South Carolina is I love those alligators, those snouts the bags, and the Spanish moss. Now, can't you just see anything happening when there's Spanish moss?
And alligators.
Yes.
That's the last alligator in Oklahoma. It's been a while.
Well, actually, we do have them occasionally. It's so sad. Well, people have them as pets, and then they let them go. And, of course, the winter is usually too severe. They just caught an alligator the other day in one of our lakes. But we don't have them everywhere, and they're not 12 feet long and so ominous. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're amazing creatures. Mm-hmm. And they're everywhere, you know, in South
they
Carolina.
They really do look like something out of prehistory.
Oh, they yes. do. They do. They're so powerful looking.
And they're fast.
Oh, very fast.
30 miles an hour, apparently. Uh-huh. For only a short distance, though.
Yeah, but they got you.
They got you. That's right.
All you have to do is run 31 miles an hour. That's
right. And don't trip. They always have the woman in the
Do not fall down.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. This morning, Carolyn, you were saying something very interesting about, I probably won't get this quite right, about the greater scope that the traditional mystery allowed you over the suspense story or novel.
Yes. Well, my sense is that with the suspense novel, certainly you can have wonderful characterizations, but the emphasis is always upon pace. Mm-hmm. You know, they build to the very fast, intense sense of excitement. And in the traditional mystery, what I really like the best is the fact that you get to know these people and you have a sense of them as real human beings and people who are struggling with temptation, with desire, with despair. Agatha Christie once said that the mystery was, the modern mystery, that they were parables. And that's how I see the mystery, because we're telling stories about people who have succumbed to sin. And we are seeing a graphic representation in the book of what happens in lives when people do not do what they should do. Mm-hmm. So, to me, the traditional mystery, I never make any apology. I am proud to be a mystery mm-hmm. writer. I think mysteries are incredibly important socially, and they are intellectually challenging. But most of all, mysteries are an affirmation of goodness. Mm-hmm. No one ever picks up a mystery unless they want the world to be a good place. Mm-hmm. So that's why we write them, and that's why people read them. You know, so.
That's a wonderful summation of it,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Well, I've kept you all here awfully late, and so I guess we probably should close soon. Is there anything, any other remarks?
Well, now we'll all line pet thinking of all the things
that we should say.
We can go on if you'd like. For sure.
We can rewrite it.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I've enjoyed it so much. And
we kind of like each other.
I can tell that, and I think our listeners will see that too. So, well, good night then. Thank you.
It's been a long road, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Music for this podcast was taken from Sergei Prokofiev's Piano Sonata No. 7, performed by Vadim Kiyamovich. Mixing and sound editing were done by Emily Giuliano. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.